Well, Justice Barak has straddled three careers, the university, high office as Attorney General of Israel, and as Justice and then President of the Supreme Court. Most of us are content to make a small mark in one. He's achieved high distinction in all three. Justice Barak was educated in Israel at the Hebrew University, which culminated in a doctorate on vicarious liability. He then spent a year doing research at Harvard and has been a visiting professor at Yale various times since. He holds a doctorate, an honorary doctorate, from numerous universities. To many of us, he's known for his judgments and his scholarship, having written extensively on adjudication and now more recently on human rights. His books and articles make a major contribution to the understanding of the judicial process and the variables of interpretation. Justice Barak's lecture tonight is entitled Rights and Their Limits, the Principle of Proportionality. After the lecture, there will be a brief period for discussion, and tomorrow there will be a seminar held at St. Hugh's College to follow up the ideas and themes of the lecture. Anyone who hasn't yet enrolled and would like to, please feel free to let us know. Perhaps you could let Judy Niner or Phil Dines from the Foundation know of your intention, but you're most welcome. So that will be tomorrow morning at St. Hugh's College. We will tax Justice Barak a little more closely on anything he might say tonight. Justice Barak, it's a pleasure to welcome you.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, human rights are rights of humans as members of society. Their rights vis-à-vis others, whether collectively or individually. The concept of a right is derived from the concept of a society. Without a society, the idea of rights has no meaning. Upon formation of society, we must acknowledge its authority to prevent its members from acting solely according to their will or interest. Thus, societies confront the dilemma: which limitations should be placed on an individual's will or interest? Of course, totalitarian governments impose limitations that differ dramatically from those in democratic societies. So I will concentrate, of course, only on democratic societies. Human rights are central to modern democracies, built on the ruins of the Second World War and the Holocaust. Democracy, however, cannot exist solely on the basis of human rights. Democracy requires the possibility of imposing limitations on human rights. And these limitations are generally of two types. The first includes limitations on one person's rights that are necessary to allow other persons to exercise their rights. Recognition of the rights of others is an appropriate rationale for democracy to limit a person's rights goes back as the Declaration on the Rights of Man and the Citizen of 1789. A second type of limitation, and this is the type I will concentrate today, a second type of limitation includes limitations on human rights that are necessary for a society to achieve its goals. Democracies may restrict an individual's rights in order to ensure the continued existence of the state itself, preserve its democratic nature, maintain public health or order, and provide public education, among other national or collective objectives. To achieve those goals, the state may limit human rights. It also may impose duties on people, including the ultimate duty to sacrifice one's life to protect the country. This special nature of democracy, which is based on a cooperation between society and individual, is thereby realized. Thus, democracy is based on a proper relationship between the interests of society and human rights. Both society's interests and human rights are part of a unified legal structure that both determines the scope of human rights and allows for their limitation. What is the proper relationship between human rights and society's interests? This is, of course, the crucial question. When is the state justified in restricting human rights? There is no universally accepted answer to those questions. Rather, the response varies from society to society, from era to era. Thus, each democracy gives meaning to this relationship, to this proper relationship, according to its own circumstances, reflecting that society's problems, challenges, history, and self-perception. We may find that post-World War II Germany, after the Nazi atrocities and the Holocaust, views human dignity as the central component of its democracy. Not surprisingly, the primary values in the post-apartheid South Africa are equality, human life, and dignity. And not is it surprising that Israel strives for the proper relationship between the public needs and individual rights in realizing the values of Israel as a democracy and as a Jewish state. Those are the central features of democracies. However, the degree of their centrality varies from one democracy to another. As a result, democracies disagree on the proper relationship between human rights and society's interest. And this is the geometric point, if I may say so, in which proportionality comes in. So I'm now moving to discuss proportionality. So proportionality formulates a conceptual framework for defining the appropriate relationship between human rights and considerations that may justify their limits in a democracy. Proportionality is an analytical, methodological doctrine. It is a legal construction. In and of itself, it does not provide any substantive solution as to the appropriate relationship between human rights and the justification of their limitation. Proportionality in itself is neither liberal nor communitarian. It is sustained by facts, by data, external to it. This is both the strengths and the weaknesses of proportionality. The point of departure for understanding proportionality, it seems to me, is the basic distinction between the scope of a right on a constitutional level and the limitation imposed on it on a sub-constitutional level, which prevents the realization of the full scope of the right. Determining the scope of a constitutional right requires interpretation of the right. It endeavors to interpret the right in a manner that realizes its underlying purposes. My view is, and I know it's not agreed by everyone, my view is that the scope of the right, does not vary as a result of conflicting constitutional ideals, such as society's interest, like security, public peace, or other conflicting rights. The clash, according to my view, the clash between conflicting interests and ideals, whether of public or private, need not be expressed in the scope of the right on the constitutional level, but rather in the answer to the question of how to exercise and to realize the right on a sub-constitutional level. The sub-constitutional level is the level at which proportionality operates. Proportionality, and I'm starting with proportionality in the broad sense, I distinguish between broad sense, regular sense, and strict sense. So proportionality in the broad sense is based on two principal components. The first is legality, which is concerned with the requirement for a chain of authorization between the sub-constitutional norm, which limits the constitutional right, like a statute, and the constitution. And just a footnote, this raises many problems for common law countries, which I think have not been looked deeply enough until now. The second component is legitimacy, a requirement fulfilled by compliance with requirements of proportionality in the regular sense. So here we come to the other sense of proportionality. Its concern is with the conditions that justify the limitation of a constitutional right by a sub-constitutional norm. There are two main justificatory conditions: an appropriate goal, proper goal, and proportionate means. An appropriate goal is a threshold requirement. Even this is disputed, but that's my view. In determining the appropriateness of a goal, no consideration is to be given to the means utilized by the sub-constitutional norm for attending the goal. And this is another open question, but that's my view. A goal may be appropriate, let's say security, even if the means of attaining it are inappropriate, because they affect the rights too much. The proportionate means must comply with three criteria, which are quite known in the literature. A, there must be a rational connection between the appropriate goal and the means utilized by the sub-constitutional norm for its attainment. B, the goal cannot be achieved by means that are less restrictive of the constitutional right. The goal cannot be achieved by means if there are less restrictive ways to affect the right. And three, and there must be a proportionate balance between the social benefit of realizing the appropriate goal and the damage caused to the constitutional right, which is called proportionality stricto sensu, or the proportional effect. And as you will see, most of what I'll be talking to you is this last item in proportionality. Proportionality stricto sensu, or the proportional effect. But proportionality generally fulfills two functions. On the one hand, it prohibits the limitations of human rights by a sub-constitutional norm, like a statute or a common law doctrine. On the other hand, subject to certain conditions, it permits a limitation of human rights by a proportionate sub-constitutional norm. Proportionality thus reflects the idea that constitutional rights and its limitations are flip side of the same constitutional concept. Proportionality expresses the idea of the relativity of human rights. The unique importance of proportionality is that these limitations themselves have their limits. So there's limits to the limits. From among the components of proportionality described above, I will focus on proportionality stricto sensu, because in my mind, it is the most important component of proportionality. A disputed question, of course. What then are the basic requirements of proportionality stricto sensu? You see, I'm trying to go slowly to the more precise point. Proportionality stricto sensu is a consequential test. Its fundamental requirement is for an appropriate relationship between the benefit gained by the law that limits a human right and the damage caused to the right. The key word here is, of course, a relationship, an appropriate relationship. The requirement is a requirement of balancing. So that's the major feature of proportionality stricto sensu. It is equal to balancing. Proportionality stricto sensu does not examine the relationship between the goals of the law and the means adopted for its achievement. It's not a goal and mean relationship per se. Rather, it examines the relationship between the goal of the law and the human rights. It's the goal of the law and the human right affected by it. It focuses on the relationship between the benefit gained by the law's realization in comparison to its effect on human rights or on the human rights affected. It is based on striking a balance. On a constitutional level, it enables the continued existing of the conflicting principles or interests. This is the point I mentioned earlier, I repeat it. In cognizance of the inbuilt and unsolved constitutional conflict. So I do think that on the constitutional level, if there is a conflict between one human right and another human right, or if there is a conflict between one human right and a public good, this conflict is not solved on the constitutional level. The conflict is there to stay. That's the beauty of constitutional law, that it's full of conflicts. Whenever you have one idea, you have the opposite idea, the ante. The solution to the conflict is on the sub-constitutional level. It's on the level of the statute that affects the right, and the question is the constitutionality of this statute. The balancing doctrine establishes a criteria for realizing this balance within the framework of proportionality stricto sensu. And here comes the question, and this is the major question. How are we to conduct the balance? How do we do the balance? And this is the key question to be answered by a balancing doctrine. I will try to develop this idea, how to draw the balance. But it's a very complicated idea, and not everyone will agree with me on that. So follow me how I think this kind of balance should be made. Balancing, of course, is a metaphor. It assumes a scale. On the one side of the scale, there are goals to be achieved. This is the society's interest. On the other side, there are the deleterious effects on the right. The right is affected. And the question is, how are we to determine the weight of each side of the scale? How are we going to realize this metaphor of balancing? And my answer is that the criterion for determining the weight of each side of the scales is that of the relative social importance. The relative social importance attached to each of the conflicting principles or interests at the point of conflict. It assesses the importance to society of the benefit gained by realization of the law's goals, as opposed to the importance to society of preventing the limitations of a given human right. The key question thus, and you see we have run from one question to another, the key question thus is how to determine the relative social importance of the benefits in terms of its contribution to society on the one hand, as opposed to the relative importance of preventing the limitation of the human rights in terms of the damages caused to it. How do we do it? This determination, I must say in the beginning, is neither scientific nor precise. I mean, don't look for any scientific formula, A plus B multiply, it doesn't work this way. This determination is neither scientific nor precise. The task of comparing benefit to the damage is an arduous and daunting one. How can one compare the benefit to the state security to the damage to freedom of speech? It seems to be an impossible exercise. And please note, I am not talking yet who makes the balance. Maybe the judge, it may be the administrator, it may be the legislator. Think about the legislator. So let's take the courts out of the picture. So think about the legislator who takes his job very seriously and he just wants, or she wants to know how to make the balance. So how can one compare, or how can the legislature thus compare the benefit to the state security and the damage to freedom of speech, for example, or other freedom, other human rights? Bearing these difficulties in mind, at the very outset, it seems appropriate to make two clarifications which reduce the magnitude or the size of the problem. And here are two clarifications that shrink the problem. Firstly, the comparison is not between the advantages realizing goal as opposed to the damage brought by limiting the right. It is not between security and liberty. That's not the question at all. The comparison is between the marginal benefit, between the marginal benefit to security and the marginal damage to liberty caused by adopting of the law. Because the law is not created in a vacuum. There is already an existing situation which makes some way or another balance between those society interests and the human right. And here comes a statute that wants to change it. And the question is this change, which works on the margins, this marginal change, is it constitutional? As such, the comparison is concerned with marginal or incremental importance of the two sides of the balance. Secondly, there is even a clarification within the clarification. Secondly, we must take into consideration the existence, if there exists, but the possibility of the existence, of a proportionate alternative which achieves only part of the goals and affects only partly on the right. This will not be good enough in the second step of proportionality, that there is an alternative, that there shouldn't be an alternative that achieves the same goals but affects the right in a lesser way. So it affects the right in a lesser way, but it doesn't achieve the goals. It achieves less of the goals. So it will pass, this statute will pass the second stage. But when we think about the constitutionality of the statute, the appropriateness of the statute. In English law terms, should there be a declaration of non-compatibility? For the purposes of this lecture, I don't make a distinction between them. We should take into account, then this possibility comes in again. We should take into account the existence, if it exists, of an alternative which achieves only part of the goals and affects only part on the right. If indeed a proportionate alternative exists, and in many cases in the court, I mean, from my experience, the petitioners wouldn't, or the state, and the state would not argue about the existence of a less intrusive alternative with less fulfillment of the purpose. If such an alternative exists, and in many, many cases, such an alternative not only exists but is not disputed by the parties, then the comparison between the marginal benefit and the marginal damage is conducted having consideration for and in comparison with the proportionate alternative. So you see how the problem shrinks. However, this dual clarification does not transform the balance into a factual problem. That's not my claim. I will not run away from the problem. I just try to clarify it. It cannot eliminate the value-based discretional nature of balancing. It shows, however, that the value-laden question confronted by the decision-maker, the legislator, the judge, the executor, is not the large balance or the heavy balance between general principles such as security or freedom, life or quality of life. Rather, the decision-maker is confronting a balance of smaller dimensions, namely the need to balance between marginal advantage to the law's goals, apart from the proportionate alternative, and the importance of preventing the damage to the constitutional right deriving therefrom. And now the question is, okay, how do you do it? Or how do you think about doing this type of balancing? Let's start with the assessment of the marginal importance of realization of the goal, so the state interest involved. On this side of the scale, there is the goal which the law purports to realize. This goal is deemed appropriate, because if we reach this stage, we are already past the stage of the question if it's appropriate goal. Yes, it is appropriate. So this goal is deemed appropriate if it satisfies the threshold requirement pertaining to an appropriate goal, both in terms of the substance and in terms of its urgency. This goal must belong to the categories of recognized expressly or impliedly as of goals justifying the limitation of human rights. So security is one of them. So in this respect, it's easy. In fact, most cases pass this threshold. This goal also reaches the level of urgency required in order for the goal to be considered as appropriate. The urgency of the threshold is disputed in comparative law, but in Israel, what we adopted is a pressing or substantial social interest. So even this, usually, is we are passing it. Unlike in America, here, strict scrutiny is very strict. It's strict in theory, fatal in practice. But in the non-American scene, and we are talking about here in the non-American scene, because proportionality is, I can't say unknown, but it's just starting to appear in America in minority opinions. But in the continent, all over the world, but America, these questions come up, and when the urgency is taken into account, and even if the formula is a very strict formula, like the one I'm using here, namely substantial social interest or pressing social interest, usually it passes. I've checked several jurisdictions, and it was very difficult to find a case that one doesn't pass this type of requirement. Lastly, the examination of the we should take also into account the probability, the chance of realizing the goal if the law remains in effect. We must consider it too. This, of course, depends on the factual data and the prognosis regarding the possibility of realizing the appropriate goal. So you can imagine, it's quite clear that if the prognosis, the probability that a goal will be realized is 20%, it's small, and the effect on the right is tremendous, that this affects the balance between the two sides of the form, of the scale. Okay, let's move now to the second end of the scale, the importance attached to prevent the marginal effect on the right. Here an important question comes in. If we will not solve it, it's very difficult to continue. And the question is, are all human rights of equal importance? Do rights differ in their level of importance? For purposes of balancing, I'm talking. Couldn't it be argued that their normative equivalence means, because both of them are, let's say, on the constitutional level or on statutory level, that their that the fact that they are normative equally means that they are also of equal importance? The answer is that a distinction must be drawn, in my mind, between the question of constitutional status and the question of social weight. The constitutional status of a right is determined according to the interpretation of the Constitution. Absent any constitutional guidelines to the contrary, the assumption should be that all constitutional rights enjoy identical constitutional status. But rights on the same normative level are not necessarily the same, do not have necessarily the same social importance. The social importance of a right, and by extension its weight in relation to the conflicting principles, is derived from its underlying rationale and its importance in the framework of a society, of the society's fundamental concepts. In comparative law, one may find support for the idea that not all constitutional rights are of the same importance. The distinction between various rights in terms of their relative importance provides the central basis for the distinction between three levels of scrutiny under American constitutional law. South African Constitution of 1996 states that the constitutionality of a law that limits constitutional rights must inter alia take into account the nature of the right. The prevailing approach in South Africa is, though I don't think there are cases on it, but at least in the literature, is that the right of dignity, equality, and liberty, and their derivative rights are all of central importance in South African society. Having said that, I must concede that comparative law also bears evidence to a different and opposing view, according to which all constitutional rights are of equal importance. On a theoretical level, on a high level of abstraction, not on a de facto level, but on a high level of abstraction. This is, for example, the German approach and the Canadian approach to constitutional adjudication. In my view, and you will find the Israeli cases full with this idea, in my view, not all constitutional rights are of equal importance, and they are not all equal in terms of the weight attached to them. The importance attaching to a constitutional right and the importance of preventing its limitation are determined in accordance with society's fundamental concepts. They are influenced by each society's social history and its particular character. So think about dignity in Germany and equality in South Africa. They are derived from the goals of the Constitution, a right that constitutes a condition for the existence and exercise of another right may be regarded as being more important among the two. From this, we may infer the relative importance of the right to life, human dignity, equality, and political expression, because all of them are conditions for the realization of many other rights. And there are additional factors that can be taken into account. The weight attached to the side of the rights on the scale derives not only from the importance of the right, but also from the extent of its limitation, its intensity, and its dimensions. A limitation of only one right differs from limitations of additional rights. A limitation nearing the margin of the right differs from a limitation nearing its core. A temporal limitation is less severe than a permanent limitation. Limiting the rights of a small number of right holders is not the same as limiting the rights of a large number. We thus see that the consequence of the limitation of a human right and its effect on this entitled to the right affect the weight of the right. Lastly, the probability of actual limitation of the constitutional right is an important factor in determining the weight attached to the damage liable to be caused to the right. While the probability of the actual limitation of the right is high, the weight attached to the limitation itself will be greater than where the chance of an actual limitation are slight. This aspect I must mention to you of the limitation of right has not been stressed in the legal literature. And it seems that the reason for it is because in most of the cases, the actual limitation of the right is certain and immediate. So we don't think about it. We don't take it into account. When the infringed law is passed, the right is immediately affected. But this indeed is true in most cases, but not always. In cases in which there is no certainty that the right will be limited, then the degree of uncertainty, the likelihood of its materialization, will have an effect on the weight attached to the right affected. Okay, so where do I stand now? So I take all this into account. And now I think we are ready to think about the balancing itself, the way to balance those two sides of the scale. And this balancing, according to my theory, is not done by one formula, but by several formulas or by several ways of thinking, going from the more abstract to the more concrete. So what is the most abstract way of thinking for the balancing process? Well, the most abstract thinking for the balancing process, what I call the basic balancing, the basic balancing rule can be expressed as follows. And here I express a rule for balancing, on the most basic rule. To the extent that greater importance attaches to preventing the marginal damage to a human right, And to the extent that the probability of the rights being limited is higher, the marginal benefit to the public interest brought by the limitation must be greater, of greater importance, of greater urgency, and with greater probability of materialization. Okay, that's the formula. And I, as a judge, work with this formula, if you want, on a daily basis. It's a very high level of abstraction. And it's not the only level of abstraction. There is another level of abstraction, a very low level of abstraction. Later, I will immediately try to convince you that we should have a third one. The lowest level of abstraction is the what is called the ad hoc balancing, or the concrete balancing. This is basically the ad hoc balancing, or the concrete balancing, is a realization of the basic rule. The basic balancing balances between the benefit and the limits in the broad sense, the high level of abstraction. The concrete balancing rule balances in accordance with the criterion that is very, very narrow. It is geared to the facts of the case, of the special circumstances of the case. The basic balancing is based on generalizations on a very high level of abstraction, whereas the concrete balancing is based on a very low level of abstraction. And the transition from the high level of abstraction to the particular synthesis of the case at hand is sharp and acute transition. Such sharp transition, I think, is undesirable. And in that sense, the basic balancing rule is too abstract. I hope you sense it when I formulated it. It's too abstract. It fails to relate to the particular features that characterize the various human rights. The concrete balancing, on the other hand, is too particularized. It is ad hoc, as the name indicates. You cannot learn from one case to the other because everyone is so specific according to its own circumstances. And this prompts the question which I asked myself for several years at home, is the question of the possibility of an intermediate level between the basic and the concrete, between the basic balancing and concrete balancing. Should there be what I call a principled balancing? That's words, but let me call it this way. Should there be a principled balancing that translates the basic balancing rule into a number of principled balancing rules formulated at a lower level of abstraction than the basic balancing rule and at a higher level than the concrete balancing rule? This level of abstraction would give expression to the considerations of principle at the basis of the constitutional right and the justification for its violation. How would one formulate this intermediate level? So that's my further question that I have to answer. What differentiates it from concrete balancing, and what is its justification? The principle balancing formula would translate the basic balancing rule into a principle formula that relates to the limited right on the one hand and to the special goal limiting the law on the other hand. I'm talking, of course, everything in margins, as I mentioned earlier. It would establish the conditions to be satisfied by the limits, by the limiting law, so that the limitation of the constitutional right would be proportional or strict to sense. Let me give you an example. Take a law that limits the right of political expression, a right of great importance, of course. Assume that the goal of the limitation is the protection of public peace in face of hate speech. So that's we have the right, freedom of expression. Think about the marginal, of course, only. And you have the public need to prevent hate speech. The principle balancing formula might determine that it is only permissible to limit freedom of political speech when the goal of protecting the public peace from the consequences of hate speech is crucially important. So here we are coming to the urgency. It's crucially important for realization of an urgent social need that is required to prevent extensive and immediate, for example, if this is what one society wants to have, and to prevent extensive and immediate damage to the public peace. The principal balancing formula is thus characterized by the level of abstraction that gives expression to the reasons underlying the right and the justification for the limitation. I will now leave it as it is. And I will like to raise some criticism and give some answers. Proportionality, as you probably know, is central to the doctrine of rights. Most of constitutional democracies have adopted proportionality as a central criteria for resolving the problems posed by complex relationship between individual and society in modern democracies. Proportionality is a nice example of migration of constitutional law. And as we have seen, proportionality is based on the concept of balance. Its role is not to determine the scope of the right, as I said, but rather the justification for its protection or its limitation. The advantage of proportionality stricto sensu, within these three levels of abstraction, are several, and let me mention to you several, not all of them. It stresses the need to look always for a justification. It stresses to look always for a justification of a limit on a human rights. It's not enough, like, for example, the Americans' three levels of scrutiny. It's not enough that you say this belongs to strict scrutiny, and then the solution is solved. No. You have to ask all the time the justification for affecting this right. It structures the mind of the balancer. It structures the mind of the balancer. It is transparent. It creates a proper dialogue between the political branches and the judiciary, because one branch knows exactly how the balance was done by the other branch. It adds to the objectivity of the judicial process. But proportionality stricto sensu, or balancing, has its critics. It is said that balancing attempts to balance incommensurable items. This is a typical criticism of balancing. My answer is that there is a common base for comparison, namely the social marginal importance. I mean, I started with this. So this kind of argument, I think, doesn't hold water. It is said that balancing is irrational. I try to show that balancing rules, basic, principled, concrete, supply a rational basis for balancing. It gives discretion, but I don't think that discretion prevents rationality. It is said that proportionality stricto sensu protects rights less than its alternatives. I mean, this is a major criticism of the proportionality endeavor. It is said that in legal systems that don't use proportionality, which means that don't use balancing, human rights are protected more. I don't agree, but in order to prove it to you, this is a separate lecture. But let me only summarize in one sentence why I don't think so. In the critical case of strict scrutiny, if I take the American view and the strict scrutiny, because in the other levels of scrutiny, they clearly lose to proportionality. That goes without saying. But the battle is on strict scrutiny. So in the crucial case of strict scrutiny, where there is no possibility to prevent over-inclusiveness, think about Korematsu in the true sense, not in the facts of Korematsu, but let's assume that 20% of the Japanese were connected with Japan. And you cannot distinguish between them because there is no criteria that you can distinguish between those who will go with the Japanese and those who will be loyal to America. What do you do then? It's over-inclusive. If in an over-inclusive situation, proportionality, strict scrutiny would say, okay, if you cannot distinguish, make this kind of distinction, then it passes the strict scrutiny. If this is the situation, then proportionality is much more protective because proportionality has done the balancing proportionality stricto sensu stage, which in America you don't have. On the other hand, if in this Karamazov situation, 20%, the American doctrine will say, in this case, it doesn't pass scrutiny, and I'm very doubtful if in time of war or of terror, this is what the Americans will say. If this is what they say, then they may protect human rights better than under proportionality. And the answer to this question is an open answer under American doctrine. I have researched it quite substantially. Until now, you have seen, I have discussed the balancer, and I have made no distinction between the legislature, the administrator, and the judge. But let me now enter into my last phase. What about considerations pertaining to the relationship between the political branches, the legislative and the executive, and the judicial branch? I present a balancing model that is applicable to any body conducting balance. This was my starting point. Accordingly, my position regarding proportionality would remain intact, even in the total absence of judicial review. I always, when I talk with students about proportionality, and I always hear, yes, but why can judges do it, etc., I say, forget about the judges. No judges. All the judges were killed. A bomb killed all the judges. But the legislator, the administrator, they want to know exactly how to do the balancing. And here, this was my formula to do the balancing. So I would stick to it, even if there is no judicial review at all. Therefore, it is, of course, applicable within the framework of judicial review under the Human Rights Act, which, as you know much better than I know, is a very peculiar situation of non-compatibility, which is neither constitutional or not non-constitutional. I will not go into this question now, but the criteria for me is the same criteria. An examination of proportionality doctrine shows that the relevant extent of discretion, if I move now to this question of discretion, an examination of proportionality doctrine shows that the relative extent of discretion exercised by the legislator or administrator and the judge will vary in accordance with the components of proportionality. So you have to go very clearly according to the different components, and you will see who has more and who has less discretion. For example, in the decision of whether to act legislatively or administratively, the discretion of the legislature or the administrator is extremely broad, and the judicial discretion is extremely limited. In determining the goals, the means, and the prognosis of their effect, the legislature or administrator has broad discretion, and judicial discretion is quite narrow. However, to the extent that we move deeper into the analysis of the components of proportionality, the scope of legislative or administrative discretion decreases. And when we reach the proportionality stricto sensu stage, what I was talking to you today, and making the balance, judicial discretion is broad and legislative discretion is narrow. I made this point in one of the cases in which I was dealing and I was deciding that the separation, the construction of the separation fence of Israel in the West Bank was illegal. And here is what I wrote. And many politicians didn't like it at all, you can imagine. The military commander is the expert regarding the military quality of the separation fence route. Nothing for the judges to say about it. We are experts regarding the humanitarian aspects. They should think about it too, of course, but we are the experts, so to say. The military commander determines where, on hill or plain, the separation fence will be erected. It's not for judges to say where to put it. This is his expertise. We, the judges, examine whether this route harms the local residents, whether this route's harm to the local residents is proportionate, stricto sensu. This is our experience. It is my view that it is proper in a democracy to entrust the judiciary, the unelected, unrepresentative, everything what you want to say, judiciary, to be the final decision maker, subject, of course, to constitutional amendments, etc., about the proper ends that cannot be achieved because they are not proportionally stricto sensu. That there are certain lines of proportionality, stricto sensu, that the political branches are forbidden to cross. In this context, let me cite a case in which the Supreme Court, my Supreme Court, ruled that a statute that prohibited family unification between Israeli Arab citizens and their non-Israeli spouses from the West Bank, and the reason for it was security reasons, because they found out in more than 20 cases that this non-Israeli spouse who entered to Israel by family unification program was assisting a suicide bomber in planting a bomb in a coffee house, in a university cafeteria, in the streets, in buses, etc. And therefore they stopped for 1 year to be continued. They stopped the whole program for family unification. And the question was, is this statute that prevents family unification because of security reasons, and the reasons were security reasons, though, so it passed the proper purpose criteria, is it constitutional? Or is it not constitutional, unconstitutional, because it affects human rights, and the right affected, and on this most of us agreed, is dignity, because we have dignity as a human right. And we decided that family, for families to live together is a constitutional right, and for families to live together in Israel, not that the Israeli will go out of Israel. For the families to live together in Israel is a constitutional right. But the question then comes up, is the effect on dignity proportional, stricto sensu, to the purpose to be achieved? In other words, is the move, the marginal move, from the previous program, which is individual checking, to a total ban? This is the marginal move as far as the right is concerned. Is it proportionate to achieving the goals, namely to prevent those acts of terror by spouses? Because if the spouses will not be let in, the spouses will not commit the terror. And here is what, and we said, no, it's not constitutional. It's not proportional stricto sensu. And everything was on that question. And here is what I say. Examination of the test of proportionality in the narrow sense returns us to first principles that are the foundation of our constitutional democracy and the human rights that are enjoyed by Israelis. These principles are that the ends do not justify means. I mean, that's proportionality stricto sensu. That ends do not justify means. Security is not above all else. That the proper purpose of increasing security, you see, the marginal, the proper purpose of increasing security does not justify serious harms to the lives of many thousands of Israeli citizens. Our democracy is characterized by the fact that it imposes limits on the ability to violate human rights, and that it is based on the recognition that surrounding the individual there is a wall protecting the rights which cannot be breached even by the majority. I must say, of course, and surely you, many of you may disagree with me on that crucial point. To the critics on that point, I have only one answer. I am aware of your criticism, but I have not found a better system. So you see, my theory is a relative theory. I'm not claiming absoluteness. I'm just claiming that I can't find a better way, which one says about democracy, as you know. It's a system with many, many problems, but we don't have a better one. I am aware of criticism, but I have found, but have not found a better system. It is my view, a view I expressed in many cases, dealing with human rights generally and the battle on terror specifically, that if we take human rights seriously, we should accept proportionality stricto sensu and judicial discretion in balancing. And let me finish my lecture by citing a judgment in which the court, I wrote the judgment, we ruled that the government has no authority to authorize torture. It was the first torture case in the whole battle against terror. And I finish my judgment by saying, this was in 19, 89, I think. So it was before September 11. We are aware that this judgment of ours does not make confronting the reality any easier. Because when we gave the judgment that you cannot torture, bombs were exploding in the streets. So, and people were thinking the way to fight this kind of bombing is to catch the terrorists and torture them so we will know where the bomb is planted. We are aware that this judgment of ours does not make confronting that reality any easier. That is the faith of democracy, in whose eyes not all means are permitted, and to whom not all the methods used by her enemies are open. At times, democracy fights with one hand tied behind her back. Despite that, democracy has the upper hand, since preserving the rule of law and recognition of individual liberties constitute an important component of her security. At the end of the day, they strengthen her and her spirit and allow her to overcome her difficulties. Thank you.
Well, Justice Barrack, thank you very much for such a fine lecture. We now have 10 minutes or so to interrogate you. Who would like to go?
Proportionately,
of course. Lady there in the front, perhaps. Yes, you. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, did you hear what I said so far? Is it the case in reality that too many judiciaries defer too readily to the executive when issues of national security are raised and don't conduct the kind of deep analysis that you set out in your lecture because they feel that it's outside their competence to look at the means and whether there are proportionate alternatives, as you described?
Well, I think, in order to give you a reliable answer, not having statistics at my hand, but in order to give a reliable answer, the only thing I should say is we have to take every legal system, its problems, its history, its dangers, etc., and to make the analysis, what is proper for that legal system. If I may use it, there is a margin of appreciation that one has to give to every legal system. What I do think is that there are, and here you are right, there are many legal systems which are giving a very strong protection to human rights in times of peace, but don't give the same kind of protection to human rights in times of war or times of terror. And what is interesting, for example, as far as we are concerned, we have started to develop, or I've started to develop these ideas when I came to the court. This was 28 years ago. I was there 28 years. And we started to develop them slowly, slowly, and we haven't changed them with the rise of terror and then decline of terror, rise of terror, decline of terror. Because if we would do that in a country like me, like mine, in which terror, you know, is part, it goes with you from the beginning, it would be impossible. So we try to develop a criteria, formulas, way of thinking that will not change, will not make any change between terror and peace. The border between terror and peace is very, very thin. And it is my view that if you develop special rules for time of war, special categories for time of war, you will not be able to get rid of them when war is over, even relatively. It will linger over the system. It will disappear. Think again about Korematsu. Korematsu was a war situation, and the American literature says, "Look, we made a mistake. The time of war, but now we have peace. Let's go on." And they did go on, and America is protecting human rights very, very strongly in time of peace. But when now September 11 comes, suddenly Korematsu becomes another, comes again, here he is. And people start to think, well, yeah, Korematsu was wrong on the facts, but is Korematsu wrong on the law, and how do you view it, etc. And, you know, no one remembers nowadays who was the general who gave the order in the Korematsu case. The authorization came from Roosevelt, but who gave the order? But everyone remembers the case of the Supreme Court, Korematsu. It's a black point, you know, on the black border. And it changed the whole graph of protection of rights in the United States, in my view, during wartime and during peacetime. But to give you an accurate answer, or to make a generalization, I wouldn't dare without doing all the proper legal and historical analysis. The legal analysis I may do, but the historical, I'm not an expert at all.
Right, who's next? Who we got? Yes.
So I want to thank you first for a splendid lecture. Applaud your court for making the difficult decisions about proportional effects that you did. But I'm a philosopher, and I want to propose to you two middle-level rules about proportionality and ask whether you think there's a difference between them and whether you have a preference between them. The first rule says that a statute that infringes rights is permitted or constitutionally permitted so long as the marginal benefit of the statute in the common currency of social importance is even just a little bit greater than the marginal harm to social importance. And the second principle is more restrictive. It says that the statute is only constitutionally permissible so long as the marginal benefit is quite a lot greater than the marginal harm that comes from the restriction of the right. So the question is whether you think that is there a difference that you can see between those principles, and if there is, do you have a preference, I mean, between those two? In other words, is it enough that there be a little bit of greater marginal benefit than harm, or does it have to be a lot more marginal benefit than harm?
Well, I of course thought about it. I'm very much hesitant between establishing rules that have to be applied either by legislatures, administrators, or judges, which are based on little more, little less. It's quite complicated. When I wrote about proportionality, I was faced with a fascinating question, which is the solution to your question. Namely, what happens if it's equal? 50-50. Of course, how do you know that it will happen? And you can't scientifically show that it's 50-50, but what is your solution to the 50-50 proposition? And there are those who think that the solution to the 50-50 proposition is, well, an assumption of proportionality, in other words, kind of procedural ways. He who bears the burden of persuasion of the facts, he should lose, etc., etc. And my view is not. I think it's a constitutional answer. And there are two answers. If it's 50-50, it means that the damage to the right and the benefit to the public good is the same. Why to declare the statute unconstitutional? Why to declare the statute unconstitutional? It's not even little more. The other argument is, if the damage to the right is equal to the benefit to the public good, let the right prevail. And that's my view.
Justice Barak, from what you said at the end of your lecture, I understood that you think that the state should, or at least your state, should not be engaging in torture. When you said that the country should fight terror with one arm tied behind its back. I take it you think that there should be no proportionality reasoning in respect of torture, that it should not be constitutional in a country with a good constitution for the state to engage in torture for any socially important purpose. Could you just say whether that is what you think and whether there are other rights that should not be subject to proportionality reasoning at all?
Well, that's, of course, is an important question. We usually say that, you know, the rights are relative, There are no absolutes, but there seems to be there are some absolutes. One is slavery, outside the torture. One is slavery. I mean, can you have a proportionate slavery system? The other one is the question of torture. Under the International Convention on Torture, proportionality should not apply, as I understand the convention. It's an absolute. This is on the international side of it. What will happen in the different legal system is another answer, another question. As you probably know, the Germans have decided recently, several years ago, that the case, you know, the aeroplane, the case with the aeroplane, I mean, they had a statute that provided that in a September 11 situation, the German army may shut down a plane even if the plane is full with hostages, in order to prevent the disaster of September 11. And the Constitutional Court of Germany decided that this is unconstitutional because it affects dignity, the dignity of the hostages. They are becoming a tool to prevent damage to other human beings. And dignity means that humans are not tools for others, for other humans. But this outcome, which seems to me justified under the German system, is in a way peculiar to the German system, because dignity in Germany is not under proportionality. This is accepted. In Germany, dignity is an absolute. It cannot be affected by proportionality. It cannot be amended. It is permanently there to stay. It's not subject to a constitutional amendment and not to a constitutional limitation. The question is, and here you are coming, I'm coming to your question, in legal systems in which all the rights are considered to be relative, in which there is no right which is considered to be an absolute, under the regular scheme of the Bill of Rights, in such a system, will you use proportionality on torture? First of all, of course, the answer will have to do with the role of international law in the legal system. If the legal system is subject to international law, then it may solve the problem. The answer is no proportionality. But what about a legal system like yours or ours, in which international conventions are binding only in the system itself, only if they are converted by transferred by a statute, and we don't have a statute transferring the rule against torture, the convention against torture. I was not faced with this question in my torture case, because my torture case had not to do with the question you asked, but had to do with a similar question, but not the same. The question was, is the state authorized to, under, let's say, September 11 situation, is it authorized to use torture? And I checked the Israeli system, and I said, no, there is no authorization. Then I added a sentence. And if the state would like to have authorization, they have to go to parliament, they have to get a statute, and we will check if the statute is constitutional. Your question. And I left the question open. Interestingly enough, no attempt was made to go to parliament and to have any legislation. So the judgment stays now as it was then. And I can't imagine that any legislation will go forward. But who knows? Politics is the art of impossible. I added another sentence into my judgment, which I also found in the German case, and this is the following. Though there is no ante authorization for torture in my system, there may be an ex post facto justification under the criminal law of necessity. So suppose take the Germans, because they have used the same formula. Here's the plane, September 11 plane, going to hit And they know that the statute is not there anymore, the statute is unconstitutional, but a person out of responsibility for human beings, a soldier, a general, shoots and knocks out, and the plane is destroyed. And he is brought to criminal trial for killing the people on the plane, for killing the innocent people, because the German Constitutional Court decided that you can use, you can shoot the plane if it kills the terrorist. That's fine. This, they didn't have a problem with that. But the innocent persons. And then the court said, well, we asked the question, and this is the same question I asked, can you, under those circumstances, would those, this soldier that has shot down the plane, does he have a justification or an excuse under criminal law? Because he acted in circumstances of necessity. In my judgment, I have a whole chapter on this question, and I show the major problems that one has with necessity under, in this case. The major question being, is necessity a defense to a public official, or is it only a defense to one individual that commits a crime, like a murder, against another individual, etc. Here it where it stands. So now you will press me to the corner. And I'm used on those questions to be pressed to the corner at home. Okay, fine, all right. So here's a new case, and the case is not, can the government authorize? But the question is the legality of the torture. Suppose there is a statute, and what will you decide? Is the statute constitutional or not? And here I have an escape clause. My escape clause, and I think with this we can close our meeting, once a judge, always a judge. And I don't want to express my view on that. The case will come to my court every day. Let them make the decision. This is my happy position that I'm not on the court anymore.
Well, Justice Derek, I think on that note we probably should bring this to an end. Thank you very much again for such a fine lecture.